Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time for sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Good afternoon to you, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
Let's talk about the NBA draft. It begins tomorrow. And what is this? The 76ers and not the Celtics have the first pick? What happened?
Well, there's nothing untoward, I can assure you.
Okay.
As part of a Celtics strategy, which remains shrouded in a certain amount of mystery, as such strategies frequently do, when multi-year considerations are in play.
I see.
You trade for something that you might have benefited from today for something that you hope you will benefit from in 2018 or 2019 or somewhere down the line when you get the picks that you're getting in response to the ones that you're giving up.
I see. So they're taking a longer-term strategy.
That's sufficiently clear, don't you think?
Yeah, well, now that you have explained
it. Dials all over Radio
Indeed
Land.
Indeed it has. Well, but, so the Celtics made a similar deal back in the 80s when they traded a number one pick for a number three pick.
Right. Worked out pretty well. Ended up with Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale. Not too shabby.
Okay, so it works. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, there were some differences, some distinctions between today and 1981, of course, was Red Auerbach was still there in 1980. Now, whether Danny Ainge can be the second coming of Red Auerbach remains to be seen in this particular instance.
He has time yet to prove that.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing about draft picks. People can celebrate on draft night and say, oh, this is great. We got so-and-so. And then so-and-so turns out to be not quite as good as everybody thought he would be. And some guy drafted down in the, you know, mid-teens or even lower turns out to be a world beater.
Hmm. Well, let's shift gears here away from the Celtics' third round pick, I should say, for this year. And
number three pick in the first round, to be accurate.
Okay. Oh, well, so that's a big difference. And
big
thank
difference.
You for the correction. Right. But let's move on to news out of the Supreme Court that has an impact on the world of sports, because the court ruled that the government cannot deny a trademark registration because a name is potentially offensive, the name of a product or a group or a company. Now, in this case was brought to court over the use of the name, I'm going to say this because it's actually the name, The Slants, and an Asian American band wanted to use this name. But the implications here for sports are that there are many teams, including Washington's NFL team, that have been facing a lot of pressure to change their names.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your response to the court's ruling?
Well, would I be too skeptical if I were to point out that there's nobody on the Supreme Court who's ever been referred to by that particular R word? That is the nickname of the football team that does business in Washington, D.C.
Are you pointing to the lack of diversity on the United States Supreme Court?
Yeah, in this particular respect. And this strikes me as, I don't know, people have to make up their own minds on this sort of thing, I suppose, and the Supreme Court has apparently made up its mind. But the overwhelming evidence is that most people who were most sensitive to this issue consider that word a slur,
mm-hmm.
a racial slur. And for the people running the Redskins to continue to call the team that seems to me not only insensitive, but pretty stupid in terms of a business practice. But there are lots of people who are, you know, very serious about their allegiance to the team as named. And so far, they've prevailed.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, okay, so the Supreme Court made its ruling, so perhaps no legal recourse for people who don't like Washington's name. But there's always you know, protesting with your wallet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's protesting with your wallet. There's also the fact that numbers of people in the world of sports no longer call the team by that name.
Mm.
On Only a Game, for example, I refer to it as the franchise doing business in Washington, D.C. There are people with whom I speak on the program who continue to use the nickname of the team or the official name of the team, but I don't, and lots of people don't.
Well, so there are multiple ways then to have your voice heard. Let's move on to golfing news, because in October, The PGA is going to be – you're laughing already. They're going to be changing their drug policies. Well, is this not a good thing?
They are changing their drug policy. They're going to be able to draw blood and test players. My favorite response to this comes from the ever-dependable Golf Week magazine, which
now you got me laughing.
Which this is why it's a good thing, according to Golf Week, and I'm quoting, "The PGA Tour attracts fans in part because the athletes are incredibly clean living lads, and the new policy and anticipated absence of announcements of drug cheats will only reinforce their purity and quiet those who've been suspicious." Tiger Woods and John Daly come to mind.
Wait, are we talking about the same sport here?
If this wasn't written tongue-in-cheek, I'm completely baffled by it. I'm very uncomfortable with this because, unlike, for example, Major League Baseball, there is nothing on the golf tour that resembles a players' association. So there's no negotiation. The people who run the tour simply say, here's what we're going to do. And if an individual player were to stand up and say, wait a minute, I don't like the idea of your drawing blood from my arm when there's no reason to suspect that I'm cheating. You're just doing it because you have the right, as you have said, mm-hmm. you have the right that you've given yourself to do this. There's no negotiation. Baseball, the Players Association negotiates with the people representing the owners and the league, and they come to some sort of compromise. Yeah, you can test. You can do it this many times a year. This is the penalties. This is how it's going to work. I don't like the idea that management can simply impose this on a group of athletes, even a group of athletes as lavishly compensated as the people who play golf on the PGA Tour.
There's always the counter argument, Bill, though, that you should have nothing to worry if you've got nothing to hide.
Yeah, and that's an argument with which I'm fairly uncomfortable. It's a little bit of, as far as I'm concerned, an autocratic / fascist argument. Perhaps in these days I'm slightly sensitive to
autocracy and
such
fascism
an interpretation, but I'm uncomfortable with that, and especially since we're talking about blood testing, we're not talking about urine testing, and how far removed is that from any citizen doing anything being subject to that kind of invasive testing?
Well, actually, that's a really good point, right? Because if we just reframed what we're thinking about a little bit, it's their workplace.
It is their workplace.
Imagine if,
The other excuse, of course, is golf is back in the Olympics. The Olympics have drug testing, yada, yada, yada. So golf has to be, to some extent, consistent with the Olympics, the context in which the game will be played. But likewise, Olympians, many of them children or only just past childhood, have no particular rights in these issues. And for most of them, or many of them, there's no reason to anticipate that they'll test positive. There's no reason to expect that they've broken any rules or laws.
Well, I wanted to quickly touch on one more story, Bill, because it's one that we come to again and again. It's an important one. This has to do with the NFL and brain damage, because NFL player Warren Sapp just said yesterday that he's going to be donating his brain to the Concussion Legacy Foundation after he dies. Now, Sapp, who made the announcement in a video for the Players Tribune, he details the problems he has had with memory loss and functioning since leaving the NFL.
You try to find a reason that it's not that it's my brain, that I'm not deteriorating right before my own eyes. It's the most frightening feeling, but it's also a very weakening feeling because you feel like a child. I need help.
Now, Bill Sapp said the reason why he decided to donate his brain was because of an email that he received from an NFL owner that disputed any connection between football, chronic brain injury, suicides, and, quote, all this foolish stuff. What's your response?
Well, I just wish that NFL owner would look at the results of the testing right here at Boston University, where the overwhelming majority of the brains that have been tested, the brains of former NFL players, have shown signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. You cannot make that argument anymore. Even the NFL, which clung to that argument and paid doctors to present that argument for years, simply cannot hold on to it. It's basically the same argument that the tobacco industry put forward for so long. Oh, there's simply no evidence that smoking has any link to cancer, until it was overwhelmingly demonstrated that they were wrong, and they got sued and money talked and they got clobbered and then, of course, started to sell their product overseas instead of here. But the NFL cannot make that argument with any degree of credibility any longer, and yet some individuals continue to do it.
Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear him every Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Wednesdays right here with us at Radio Boston. Bill, thank you as always.
Thank you, Meghna.